It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's our Thanksgiving special. We've lined up a crew of experts of every stripe, from the restaurant chef to a history prof. Yale history professor Paul Friedman talks what shaped our tastes for this holiday. Those sweet potatoes with marshmallows, well, they may trace their beginnings back to an ancient Arab medical handbook. Paul is editor of the book Food, A History of Taste. Vegetarian cooking for everyone author Deborah Madison is back, and she has a feasting menu that everybody's going to love. Chef Jonathan Waxman is considered a father of new American cuisine, and he brings us a chicken liver mousse to die for. Then we've got a guide to your first vegan Thanksgiving from the post-punk kitchen. And as always, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's start things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. So guys, where have you been lately?
We have been in a part of Montana that few people ever go. But let me tell you, Lynn, if you ever happen to be passing through Winnett, Montana, which you will not be, it's about 100 miles north of Billings, unless you want to see beautiful scenery. And in fact, the scenery in and around Winnett is really nice. I mean, really bucolic. But if you're in Winnett, there's a restaurant where you have to go. It's called the Cozy Corner Cafe and Bar. Now, let me tell you, somebody had tipped us off to this, and they said, you got to go to the Cozy Corner for great pancakes. And I wrote back saying, well, what's the address? And the person said, Winnett. That's the address. So we got to Winnett, and I understood what the person meant, because Winnett is literally
a one-horse
it
town.
Is a crossroads, and there's a hotel, a bar, and a grocery store. The bar wasn't even open when we got there. We waited 10 minutes. At exactly 7 o'clock, the light went on in the bar. We went in and had some really good pancakes and some terrific conversation with real Montanans.
Yeah, I was really prepared to hate this place the minute I sat down at the booth.
Why?
Because I asked if I could get some water. And the owner, the man who was taking orders, looked at me. He was so grouchy. And he said, you don't need water. There's water in your coffee. And I thought, oh, man, you know, here we go. But he's a professional grouch. And he's actually a wonderful host and plied us with some of the best pancakes and bone-in ham that we've eaten recently.
What were the pancakes like?
Well, they're very big. They're like the plate-sized pancake and very kind of light and pillowy. I mean, not thin. I wouldn't call them elegant, but neither are they in the least bit heavy. They're kind of very puffy pancakes. So 2 or 3, maybe 2 inches tall. Let's put it that way.
In this unpopulated town, while we were in the middle of our breakfast and, you know, I was still complaining that I wanted water, which he finally gave me, a bicycle marathon pulled up to the front, went in, and they all ordered pancakes.
They carbo-loaded.
They carbo-loaded there. And God
knows took off again.
They took off, and I thought it
was
a mirage.
They were going cross-country, actually.
You waved Lance Armstrong down.
Yeah, right.
How they knew the Cozy Corner, I have no idea.
So do they serve food all day?
They do, and one of the things that they're really famous for, and rightfully so, is terrific pies.
Berry pie.
Yes, berry pie, like fruit pies are great. They're, unfortunately, when we had breakfast there the first time, the pies were at that moment being made, so we couldn't have one that time. On our way back from Great Falls, which is a few hundred miles to the west, we stopped and had some pie and coffee there, and it was well worth the detour.
Wonderful crust. And we asked Buck Wood and his wife Ellen what the secret to the crust was. And, you know, she kind of shrugged her shoulders and she said, well, you know, a little dash of vinegar and cold water and shortening, which is, of course, the classic old fashioned way to make crust. And it works every time.
I'm just thinking that there's a hotel there. So you get a room. You eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the Cozy Corner, and you tuck yourself into bed and you're as happy as a clam, right?
That would work great if the hotel hadn't closed 30 years ago.
Okay, so maybe you drive a little bit and you find
get on your bicycle and
get
you
on
go
your bicycle
find
and ride there. Yeah.
So pancakes worth a journey. All
That's
right.
That's what these bicyclers were doing, obviously, is looking for hotels.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in with us here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. You know where. The website, splendidtable.org. Every Thanksgiving, I go to work on a new turkey recipe. Well, this year, one of those birds made the big time, Savour Magazine. They did a feature on our show's communal Thanksgiving, and they sent a photographer last year to shoot the feast. We wrote an article to go along with that turkey because the photos aren't really the entire story. Well, the whole experience was a reminder that the best Thanksgivings are the ones that you smile about years later. That turkey, that cover bird, was the work of Tom Vagley, husband of our producer, a great cook. Now, granted, he was a little nervous, what with the photographer lurking, and he had three other things working against him. One, unbeknownst to him, instead of a very local PC organic bird, what he had been brining for hours was a supermarket turkey already pumped up with salt and water. Two, who knew how much more water an already brined turkey could take on? And three, he didn't know that he was missing the third page of the recipe. Well, to make a long story short, there was a lot of liquid in the roasting pan, like the turkey could have easily been poached. It was a drain and reduce emergency gravy procedure, fully improvised, and nobody cared. The turkey was great, and we're all still chuckling over all the many misadventures of the day. Now, you're going to find that recipe for fast roasted turkey with apples and basil on the website, splendidtable.org. Just be sure to print all the pages.
I've got plenty to be thankful for. I haven't got a great big yacht to sail from shore to shore. Still, I've got plenty to be thankful for.
Some people mark the years by the size of children. I mark it by the pub date on books. And I can't believe that it has been 10 years since Deborah Madison published her Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. It's a classic, and despite the cliché, it really does feel like last month that she and I were first talking about the book. It's been said that what Julia Child is to French cooking, Deborah Madison is to the vegetarian movement. Well, there's a new edition of the book to celebrate its decade in print, and Deborah's here in the studio. Hey, Deborah, welcome back.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be in your studio.
I cannot believe it's 10 years.
Yeah, I know.
What has happened to you over that period of time in terms of your feelings about food?
Well, they're remarkably the same. I continue to be extremely committed to the whole movement of sourcing local foods, of encouraging local consumption. There's more of a framework now for involvement. For example, Slow Foods was just getting established in the United States 10 years ago. It's really just been 10 years, and I've been very involved with that organization. I am very involved in the Seed Savers Exchange, which, of course, is the original group that started to identify the need to not lose our heritage plants.
10 years ago, you talked about sustainability. You know, it wasn't something everybody was talking about, and now every magazine you pick up is dealing with it.
I know. And yes, farmers markets were growing, but we weren't realizing as a national community the import of them in that they have to do with local, with seasonal, with freshness, with flavor and goodness, every way you can imagine.
You know, Thanksgiving, every year, the same questions. Either I've become a vegetarian and I want to know what I can do, or I have vegetarians at the table and I want them to have a wonderful time as well. What are your feelings about the idea of simulating that turkey? Things like the tofurkey and that kind of thing?
Well, I've never been a fan of simulations, to tell you the truth. And I have to admit, I've never tasted a tofurkey, and it might just be wonderful and make people very happy. But this is one meal where I don't think a host or a guest has to worry, because of all of our national meals, there are more vegetables on the Thanksgiving table than,
that's right,
than
yeah,
you can
yeah,
imagine.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, it's a plethora. It's a harvest festival, really.
Well, you know, it's right. If you just don't put the turkey on the plate, you don't really miss
it.
Well, anything.
You know, when you think of what your plate looks like after all the dishes have made their round, I mean, you can't even find the turkey. So it actually plays in an odd way a rather minor role on the plate, even if it has a major role in the presentation.
One of the wine people we talked about, don't match wine to the turkey, match the wine to everything else in the meal. But
could you come up with a vegetarian menu? Or let's put it this way. Could you come up with a menu without a turkey?
Oh, of course.
But something really celebratory.
Sure. I mean, I think always in vegetarian cooking, Thanksgiving is no exception. You want something that catches the eye, that has some focus to it, that you go, oh, you know, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I would do something like perhaps a winter squash galette in a beautiful crust. I might even make individual ones because there you have, everyone likes a pie. You can have it again for dessert. It doesn't matter at Thanksgiving.
You know? I remember from one of your other books.
Yes.
Suppers, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Vegetarian suppers from Deborah Madison's kitchen.
There was a lasagna in there that I recall.
Oh, I love that.
That just sounds.
It's kind of an unusual one. It's a lasagna with winter squash again.
Right.
Diced very fine. Black kale. Your favorite vegetable.
Well,
one
it's
of your
from
favorites.
My people. Tuscan kale.
That's true.
Yeah.
And sage. And walnuts. And it's just a delicious dish. And this is one time I would definitely make fresh lasagna. You know, make fresh pasta, rather.
Right, right.
And because there's just nothing more succulent and better.
They're going to be on their knees. All right. So let's say, for instance, that is the centerpiece dish.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got the orange and the dark green and the white pasta. What would you have as the satellites around it?
Well, I love Brussels sprouts. No apologies ever necessary for them. And I would take some time with a Brussels sprouts dish. And there's one in the book that's made with chestnuts and with caramelized onions that I think is very good. Sweet potatoes is something we always had in our family.
Mm-hmm.
We had candied sweet potatoes, and I love them. And I'm not embarrassed to say it.
Right.
They're always the favorite
with
leftover, too.
With marshmallows or without marshmallows?
No, no marshmallows. So I just get every kind, garnet jewel, you know, every kind of sweet potato I can get and boil it and then cut them into slabs. So you have all those different colors, you know. And then I try to buy maple sugar when I'm visiting your fair city and use that.
Minnesota maple sugar?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
And use maple sugar and butter. And, you know, it's just this sweet condiment that I think it's wonderful.
With the Brussels sprouts and the chestnuts and then the lasagna would be really wonderful.
And also it's what I grew up with. You know, so I like having that every year.
Okay, what about starting with something really celebratory?
Oh, well, there's the silky mushroom pâté with scallions and walnuts that I think is absolutely delicious and stellar. And that, too, you could make a day ahead, 2 days ahead, you know, bring it to room temperature, slice it, and have it with a little crostini, and I think that would be delicious.
Deborah, thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. The same to you.
Deborah Madison is author of the classic Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. Now, Deborah's pie tradition is Concord Grape Pie. Now, you can get that recipe and all of her recipes for Thanksgiving on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our two e-newsletters, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our weekly attempt to make your midweek kitchen life a little simpler. You get a new recipe every week, along with shopping and technique tips. And our new seasonal e-newsletter, Baker's Chronicle, great recipes for weekend baking. Baking season's upon us. And the great news is, both of them are free. So go to the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a history of Thanksgiving tastes and a chef cooks at home. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. On holidays like Thanksgiving, we're all on the same page. I mean, nearly everybody in America identifies certain foods with this meal. Sweet potatoes, turkeys, cranberries, spicy pumpkin pie. Well, my question is, why? And where do these tastes for these dishes come from? Which brings me to a new book that has me intrigued. It is called Food, The History of Taste. Its editor, Professor Paul Friedman, is in the history department at Yale and a specialist in medieval social history. Now, in the book, he's brought together the work of scholars who look at food from the caveman era to today. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Paul, this book looks at taste. It's an unusual way in looking at food history. As obvious as it is, in another way, I don't think anybody's approached food history this way, have they?
I don't think so. When I put the book together, I wanted to concentrate on what people liked, what when they had a choice and were above the level of struggling for food, mm-hmm. different cultures actually preferred. And so I was interested in, for example, why did Europeans love spicy food in the Middle Ages and then completely get spices out of their cuisine by the 18th century, except for a few desserts? Or why was there such a rage for foreign tropical beverages in 18th century Europe, things like coffee, tea, chocolate? But why did the Europeans then drink them with sugar, which the peoples who had developed these drinks had not done? So these are questions of taste affecting the history of food and obviously affecting the economic history of the modern world, because the taste for these things, tropical fruits, coffee, sugar, have driven a lot of actual historical developments.
Can we look at those flavors through the Thanksgiving meal? I mean, this may take you a little afield, but I would love to know what shape the tastes for instance, you know, the turkey, the spices, the sweet flavors, the mince pie. I mean, this is where nutmeg, cinnamon, allspice, you find them in, you know, the pumpkin pie, but you often find them with the sweet potatoes and other parts of the main meal. Where did the taste for those things begin?
I think that Thanksgiving is really a celebration of New World ingredients, but done according to a European style, or at least an imagined European festive style, imagined in the 19th century when Thanksgiving got its start as a retrospective look back to colonial New England. So having a bird at the center of the meal is something that would be typical of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, where poultry, particularly things like partridges or pheasants, would be the main celebratory item of a festive meal. But in this case, it's a turkey, a New World animal. Another evocation of the European style is mixing sugar into main dishes. So having a sweet relish like cranberry sauce, or having a New World ingredient like sweet potatoes, but with those spices and sugar that you mentioned, is a little archaic even in the 19th century and meant to associate Thanksgiving with a couple hundred years earlier. So pumpkin pie, New World ingredient, but made with sugar and spices as if it was a medieval dish. The mince pie is the closest thing to an actual medieval item that is common to Thanksgiving.
Now, when you say medieval, I was reading the section of the book about Muslim medieval cuisine. And the spice part of that was so interesting, the flavors of those dishes. I kept thinking, you know, this could be a pumpkin pie.
Very much so. In the Muslim world to this day, particularly in Arabia and in North Africa, but also extending far into Pakistan and Indonesia, you would have a great variety of spices. And that is something that European cuisine lost after the Middle Ages, but that the European or Christian Middle Ages shared with and probably got substantially from the Muslim Middle Ages. Islamic cuisine was fashionable for hundreds of years.
And what I was surprised to see was that the Islamic world dominated the Mediterranean as well as far as India. I mean, this was huge.
It was huge because it was rich and it set taste patterns for territory ranging from Ireland to well into India.
My. Why this taste for spices? What was behind this taste for spices?
Some of it just is taste. That is, there are fashions. In the Middle Ages, spices also were healthful. They were regarded as drugs and as items of what we might call wellness. They lent a sense of grace and refinement, but also were thought to balance out bad properties of food, bad properties like meat and fish tended to be too cold and wet, and spices balance that cold and wetness with a kind of dry and sharp taste, or a dry and hot taste.
The sweetness. There's sweetness in our menu for Thanksgiving, really almost from beginning to end. It's that idea of sweet and savory. Did that start back in the days when sugar was something that only the rich could afford, or was there a medicinal reason behind
both.
Sweet and savory?
I would say both. sugar was quite expensive and didn't become a kind of staple item that the poor could afford until well into the 18th century. But the preference for separating savory from sweet, mm-hmm. our dislike of things like the idea of sugar on fish,
yeah.
or as was dominant until the 18th century in Italy, putting cinnamon and sugar on top of pasta,
mm-hmm.
this now seems pretty alien. We've tended to exile spices to the dessert course. So we think of cinnamon, nutmeg, and cloves as really things for cookies and cakes and candies.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving, and even more maybe Christmas, is a season when we relax our guard, the frontiers come down, and spices start to invade main courses or be served in things like mulled wine with spices, eggnog with
mm-hmm.
Nutmeg, and of course the pumpkin pie and sweet potatoes with little marshmallows and cloves that you mentioned.
So when we sit down to Thanksgiving dinner, we owe all of this to the past. It's really fascinating.
What's nice is that the past in food history is alive and that you can pick and choose, even if you don't know that you're picking and choosing,
right.
from a lot of legacies of the past.
Paul, thank you, and have a good Thanksgiving.
You too, Lynn. My pleasure.
Paul Friedman is the Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale University. His book is Food, the History of Taste.
I'm thankful because you care. I'm thankful for dreams we share. When you came along, I was born anew. That's why I'm thankful to you. Oh, I'm thankful.
Jonathan Waxman was one of the wonder cooks of the 80s. Then New York City chic was all about French food, the nouvelle cuisine, and in swooped this guy from California to open Jams. It was a new take for New Yorkers. No one had ever seen a mesquite grill, and the idea of working directly with farmers was new. His food was different, and they called it California cuisine. Many of today's star chefs credit Waxman as their mentor, and he's still at it. Now, I wanted Jonathan here today because his food always makes me hungry, and that's what you want for Thanksgiving. Jonathan's latest book is A Great American Cook. Hey, Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, you say that marriage changed your food. What happened?
Well, you know, my wife set a great scene for me. You know, she said, let's get married, let's buy a house, let's have children. I never thought I'd do any of those things. I thought I'd be a freelance bachelor forever. And she said, no, honey, that's not your life. This is your life. Let's do this differently. Yeah. So Sally really was determined to change me from this itinerant bachelor to a happy married man. And she did a very good job.
You mentioned that because your food for so many years was pretty high-flying and complex. But you talk about there was an evolution that happened. Something changed.
I think it really started when my daughter was born. And I didn't want her to eat the sort of traditional sort of jarred or canned foods. And so
right.
I would get up early in the morning and I would make her applesauce. Plain and simple. And you know what? It was kind of like, this is not a bad way to cook. And when we started really eating as a family, you know, there was things that I just loved to do that were simple and that were easy for me after a long day or a long week's work that the kids loved, my wife liked, and it was just completely satisfying.
So now with the holidays, with Thanksgiving, how do you cook for your family now?
Well, I love cooking for my family and friends. You know, we don't do a ton of people. We do about 10 or 15 people. More people show up, of course.
Right, yeah.
And I like doing things very traditionally, but also I like having a little bit of flair, because a little bit of flair, I think, always, you know, is great at Thanksgiving. And we do a lot of different things. You know, my wife, she goes to the market and she shops, and she buys the turnips, the rutabagas, and the potatoes and sweet potatoes. I bring home the turkey, of course. And then I sort of put everything out, and then my daughter, who's now 10, she comes in and says, Daddy, what are we going to cook? And then we kind of figure out what we're going to do. We always do one Brussels sprout dish. It's sort of quartered and sautéed with bacon, and we put in a little bit of cream. and we top with Parmesan cheese and bake it in the oven. Mm. And it's not a bad thing to serve.
Well, this is not a bad thing at all. It's not a bad thing at any time.
But it's simple. You know, there's only three or four ingredients in it. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. And then she goes, Daddy, let's do sweet potatoes. Uh-huh. And then she goes, can we put the marshmallows on top? I said, we'll put marshmallows on half of it, and on the other half we won't. And that's kind of how it works.
There's a recipe in your book that I think would be perfect for Thanksgiving. It's the apple and chicken liver mousse.
You know, when I was in, I worked in France, and I went to La Varenne, and
Cooking school in Paris.
The cooking school in Paris. Yeah. And I loved going to Burgundy and having that sort of classic chicken liver mousse. And I just thought it was fantastic. When I came back to America, and I started experimenting around with my own little sort of version of that dish, mm-hmm. and I realized that there's something missing for me. And so I started sauteing apples and putting the apples and the sautéed livers together and just pureeing in a little mixer and adding a little bit of alcohol, it always helped, and a bit of cream and a little bit of butter, and it came up this wonderful mousse. And one other thing I put in was nuts. Sometimes I put in walnuts, sometimes I put in hazelnuts. That added little bit of nuts with the sweetness of the apple and the delicious liver, it's an amazing concoction, I think.
The thing about it that I like is you throw it in the blender, you do it, you put it in the refrigerator, and it can hold there for a couple of days. So you can just put it out.
You can hold it for up to a week even. You could melt a little bit of butter and put it on top, so mm-hmm. that will mm-hmm. create a little layer of protection for the mousse. It'll last really a long time. And if you want to, you can freeze it. It does get a little granulated, but it's not so bad. And you could do it in small little pots. You can do it sort of separately. And you can bring it out if people show up unexpectedly. But I do agree, for Thanksgiving, it's not a bad way to start.
Well, I'm thinking you can spread it on toast. You have it with a drink. It just sounds delicious. Going back to you and your daughter in the kitchen, do you think your daughter's going to be a cook?
I have no idea, but my 7-year-old says he's going to be the chef and owner of all my restaurants. He said, Daddy, when you retire, I'm going to take you over for you.
I think I hear dynasty here.
I have no idea what my daughter wants to do. She loves to cook, but she's never said she wants to work in the restaurant business. My 7-year-old said, don't worry about it. I got you covered.
Hey, Jonathan, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
Likewise. Thank you.
Chef Jonathan Waxman is author of A Great American Cook. You can find his recipe for that apple chicken liver mousse on the website, splendidtable.org. If my informal tally of calls is any proof, there's been a big increase in people turning to the vegan lifestyle. And that's fine, except maybe on Thanksgiving, when non-vegans suddenly find themselves faced with loved ones who can't eat their food. So if this is your first vegan Thanksgiving and you need a little help, the producers of The Post-Punk Kitchen have you covered. Adam Allington has the story.
So if you're like most American families, as the big Thanksgiving meal draws near, you're probably running around buying all of the essentials. Cranberries, potatoes, squash, perhaps reserving a turkey at your local grocery store. One item probably not on your list.
Vital Wheat Gluten. You do have it? Okay, thanks. Bye.
I'm walking down a busy street in Brooklyn, New York with Issa Moskowitz, founder and co-host of the vegan cooking show, Post-Punk Kitchen. We're on a shopping mission to buy ingredients for a pre-holiday vegan Thanksgiving meal.
Okay, we're at Flatbush Avenue, just at the Key Food Supermarket, and we could see they have a little display of squash, winter squash.
Back in Issa's small but efficient Brooklyn kitchen, she says that one of the reasons for starting a vegan cooking show was to debunk certain myths about vegans that she hears all the time.
I think the biggest myths are vegans just eat lettuce and rabbit food and things like that, but that's not true. Vegans like to eat as much as the next person, I think sometimes even more. Vegans do have a sense of humor. A lot of times people are like, oh, all those vegans are so uptight and stuffy. But I think a different way to look at it would be like, no, all the omnivores making fun of the vegans aren't making funny jokes. So like if your Uncle Ted thinks it's the funniest thing in the world to pass you the turkey during Thanksgiving and you just kind of like roll your eyes at him, the onus is on Uncle Ted to come up with some better material. It's not on the vegans to laugh at every stupid joke that gets thrown their way.
For a meal like Thanksgiving, Isa says it really isn't hard to make a few simple substitutions and have food that most people won't even peg as vegan. In fact, that's the way she likes it. Just good food on its own merit. For our meal, we're having chickpea cutlets and mashed potatoes with mushroom gravy, acorn squash soup, and gingerbread apple pie for dessert.
This is so good.
Thank you.
Oh, man.
The soup is awesome. I forgot how awesome it was, and I ate it.
Issa's invited a mixed bag of friends over for dinner. A few vegans, a few vegetarians, even an omnivore such as myself. Paula Gross just moved to New York from San Diego.
I would just say for the person who is vegan, you're going to have to start cooking, basically. And don't just tell, like, your mom or your grandma that you're vegan and expect them to make something for you. Make stuff for yourself. Make the mashed potatoes without butter or sour cream. And don't talk about it. Because if you make a big deal about how everything's vegan beforehand, people are going to have this, like, preconceived notion that it's going to taste healthy or whatever. Just make food. Make it taste good, and people will like it. And then you can tell them, oh, there's no butter in this. And they'll be like, oh, wow, that's awesome. It tastes really good.
Around the room, heads nod in approval. Voices of experience from years of vegan holiday meals.
I think definitely, maybe leaving things like tofu out or tofurkey out of, like, a holiday meal.
Terry Romero co-hosts Post Punk Kitchen with Issa.
I think making dishes that focus more on things like grains and vegetables and beans, that probably will appeal to older family members because it's familiar, you know, using beets in things instead of using, soy, bacon. It will probably be, in general, like, much more accepted readily. Like, oh, I know what this is, as opposed to what is this pink plastic thing on my plate?
With traditional turkey Thanksgiving meals, I really find that the meat itself is kind of bland usually. A lot of times it's what you eat with it. And a lot of times the gravy is really what made it. And, you know, eating these mashed potatoes right here with the mushroom gravy, I have to say that I don't miss meat gravy at all.
During Thanksgiving, I think that the most important thing is that you don't have to get things that people aren't going to like to eat. Use the sides and the things that you're accustomed to and just make them vegan. So, like the stuffing, just don't use butter. Use olive oil or grapeseed oil and use all your herbs and spices that you usually do. It's just making the effort. I think people will appreciate it. Even it doesn't have to be the most delicious thing in the world and you could feel insecure about it. But I'm telling you, like, any vegan that comes home and sees a vegan stuffing from their mom will just get really happy, ridiculously happy.
Adam Allington is a reporter for KWMU Radio in St. Louis, Missouri. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what can run faster than an Olympic champ and turns blue when it makes love? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what can run faster than an Olympic champ and turns blue when it makes love? Well, you probably guessed it. It's a wild turkey. And the fact is, a full-grown wild turkey can run 55 miles an hour, and its head often turns blue when mating. Now, I think this all adds up to not a very pretty picture for those pilgrims. There is no actual record that they ate turkey at the first Thanksgiving, and I think there's no surprise here. I mean, heck, with the blue head and the speed, I'd stick with cod or pickled pumpkin or whatever the neighbors brought for potluck.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me.
pick up that phone. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. We have got Sandy from Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Sandy, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My question concerns the proper use of a meat thermometer. I mean, I know that you stick it in halfway. You don't go near any bones.
Right.
But my question has always been, okay, if the temperature is not correct, do I leave the thermometer in there?
Oh, you mean, oh, okay. Well, what kind of thermometer do you have? Because there's instant reading thermometers that are not meant to be left in the oven. They have a nasty habit of disintegrating or at least breaking down. And then there are thermometers that you can leave in the meat.
Okay, this is not an instant read. It's about 2 to 3 inches in diameter.
Okay, okay. What you can do is just leave it in the meat.
Okay.
And that way, when you open the oven door to check it or you look in the window, you'll know.
But I guess my concern was, first of all, is the plastic on it going to melt?
If it's meant to go in the oven, no. But if you can check the package, they'll tell you. Because, by the way, there are some instant readers now that have large dials.
Okay.
When you stick this in to the meat, how long does it take to get a read?
Well, that was my other question. I never know whether I should bring the meat completely out of the oven or leave it in. So I sort of leave it in with the door open.
Yeah.
It takes 30 seconds.
You may have an instant reading thermometer, and that you wouldn't want to leave in the oven.
Oh.
And the idea is, why not play it safe, okay. Right? Because if you get a read that fast, you could pull the... My concern is always, are you going to burn yourself? That meat being pulled out of the oven and sitting on the rack and the air around it, it's not going to change temperature dramatically over a minute or two. And what you want to do is, I always test in a couple of places. You know, for instance, if I'm doing a chicken, I test in the center of the breast, and then I aim for the thigh.
Oh, see, I've always heard that you shouldn't pull it out because you're going to lose your juices.
You know what? It isn't a bubble.
Okay.
Yeah, a butcher, a meat expert told me this a long time ago, and it was one of my dumb moments because, no, you don't want to go poking at meat all the time. But as he said, you know, all of that delicious moisture are in little cells. And if you poke one cell open, you know, the whole thing isn't going to drain and deflate. And I sort of thought for a minute and thought, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. So, sure, you can poke in a couple of places. You're not going to lose so much juice that it'll make a big difference.
Okay. And do you think it's preferable just to start it out with the thermometer in?
No.
Okay.
No, I think, you know, whatever you're cooking, if it's something that's meant to cook for an hour, I would check it after, let's say, 30 or 40 minutes. If it's something that's meant to cook for 6 minutes, I would check it after 3. So that's, you know, give it some time.
Okay.
Yeah. And just put it in, wait for a read, pull it out, and then you can go back in again.
Okay.
Okay?
Sounds good. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. You know, this is the kind of question people don't ask, and I wish they did, because you get more disasters that result. Hey, thank you.
It's very helpful.
You take care.
Okay.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I have got a great way to be ready to make pie at the drop of a hat. Okay, here's the deal. It turns out that every pie crust recipe has the same steps. You take a bunch of dry ingredients, flour, sometimes sugar, salt, etc., and you put that in a food processor or in a bowl, and then you add the fat, and you break up the fat, and then you add liquid. Well, all of that's going to make a better pie crust if they're frozen. So this is what you do. You take a recipe, whatever recipe it is, you measure all the dry ingredients into a heavy plastic bag, and then you measure the fat into it. And then you write on it, you know, this is 2 crust 9-inch pie, add 3 tablespoons of water and 1 egg. And you just zip it closed and put it in the freezer. And you can do a bunch of these. And then whenever you want, all you have to do is throw that in a food processor, add the liquid, and you have pie crust. And, you know, I do 4 or 5 of them, and then you're ready to go anytime you want. And by the way, any pie crust is also a tart crust. So if you don't feel like making pie, just line a tart pan. Call us 800-537-5252. We have Greg calling from Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Greg, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I've got a question about turkey.
Uh-huh.
From what I can tell, most of us eat turkey on Thanksgiving and maybe Christmas. We eat leftovers for a couple of days. Just those one or two occasions, and then that's it for most of us.
Right.
What I want to know is I'm not really talking about leftover recipes or substitute recipes. Are there some great recipes out there that don't require roasting the whole bird, don't require a commitment of an entire day, that you know, and they're not substitutes. They're turkey for turkey's sake.
Oh, Greg, you called the right woman.
Well, I had a feeling.
See, the reason is it's my husband, because he loves bird.
Oh, okay.
And so we do a lot with bird, whether it's chicken or turkey or whatever. I'll tell you what I love. I'm a wing person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, turkey wings tend to be tough unless you know what to do with them, but this is the kind of thing that's so easy. You can throw them in, you know, plastic bags in the fridge,
right,
and you put your favorite barbecue sauce or your favorite marinade in that bag, and you forget about them for a day.
Do you already cut them up, or are they
No. I leave these puppies whole.
Okay.
And I just fill bags with them, and I throw in the you know, whatever I want to marinate them in. And then what you do is you spread them in a big roasting pan, and you cover them with foil, and you have some of that marinade on them.
Mm-hmm.
And you put them in a 325-degree oven, covered with foil, completely sealed, because you got to tenderize them.
Right.
So you roast them for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, until you can stick a fork in them and you can see they're tender.
Mm-hmm.
Whip off that foil, all right? Just whip off that foil, flip on that broiler.
Okay.
Now watch carefully, because this is where you can turn them into cinders, and I have done this. But the idea is you want to broil them about 3 minutes on one side, maybe 3 minutes on another, turn them with tongs, and you have turkey wings you can eat with your fingers.
Mm.
Absolutely fabulous.
That sounds great.
Seriously, you know what I do? We make big batches, and we'll have them hot the first night. I stick them in the fridge. We then cut them up. But they're great cold, and they're cheap. And by the way, turkey wings make the best broth you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you can take turkey thighs, which are often sold independently,
mm-hmm,
okay, and you can sort of make them like ossobuco. You cut them in half. I mean, you mm-hmm take out the bone,
right,
and you just cut them in like slices, and then you kind of just, you know, tie them with a string so they're little flat rounds.
Right.
And you follow any ossobuco recipe. You know, you braise them because imagine them being superbly moist stew meat.
Right.
So you can do any stew recipe with that, but especially ossobuco, where you brown them in olive oil, and then you have celery, carrot, and onion, and white wine, and
you
let
them braise. Would you dust them with the flour first?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. You got the right idea.
Mm.
You could also take out that bone, because it's just one bone in the thigh,
right,
and the thigh is big. You could put your favorite stuffing in that, roll them up, tie them mm-hmm with string, or just put some toothpicks in and slow roast.
Oh, that sounds great. And, you know, that's kind of the thing, too, because in other parts of times of the year, I think part of what you might miss is just that whole Thanksgiving deal. So you could stuff them with some stuff that maybe
that's right
had a little sage or something.
That's
in
right.
It.
Exactly. It's a mini turkey for two people.
Oh, that's a great idea.
It's very, very simple. So think of the parts. Start looking at the parts of the bird. And by the way, I think they usually go for next to nothing. I mean, they're really economical and they're good. They're really good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get to thinking now, you know how good it is on Thanksgiving, but that's just yet, you know, it's kind of the forgotten bird.
Well, I think it is, and I think because it's so big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 16 pounds of anything is a little hard thing to deal with on a day-to-day basis. But go turkey, Greg. You're going to have a blast.
And if you hear a funny sound, that's me drooling on the phone here. So.
Hey, it usually short circuits the mic, so I can't do it while we're on the air. Hey, thank you so much. You take care.
Thank you, Lynn.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye. Just think of the turkey as, you know, the thigh is like a little roast, okay, or stew meat, and the leg is the same way, and the breast, well, the breast is white meat. You can slice it and make it into scallops, you know, or cutlets. It's very easy. 800-537-5252. Peter's on the line. He's calling from Chelsea, Michigan. Peter, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I had too much success this year.
Nobody's ever had too much success.
Have you ever grown pumpkins?
Okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What I did hear somebody talk about was sautéed pumpkin meat.
Oh, yeah.
And it just sounded really good, and I wouldn't know where to start.
Oh, it's not hard. I mean, it's a pain in the neck to get the skin off the pumpkin, but, you know, clean the pumpkin, cut away the skin, cut it into, because it takes time for it to cook, you cut it about, a quarter inch thick, right?
Okay.
And I've got, of course, you know, my first thing that comes to my mind is an Italian version, but you can vary this with seasonings and make it any country you want to. Generous amount of olive oil, big mm-hmm skillet. Put the pumpkin slices in the skillet. Get the skillet pretty hot, and then add the pumpkin slices. And using medium to medium-high heat, do a real slow brown on them. See, when they brown, they get really sweet.
Okay.
And salt and pepper them during this time.
Salt and pepper, sure.
Yeah, because it'll have a nice balance of flavor. And then what you do, as maybe you flipped over to the second side, you add a mess of thin-sliced onions.
Ooh. Ooh, yeah.
And some fresh sage leaves.
Okay.
Yeah, and you just let it brown. Just let it brown. Keep moving them around so they don't stick. Get them nice and crusty brown. And you can feel them with a knife. You can see if they're getting tender or not. And then what you do is you throw in a splash of white wine and you boil it down to next to nothing.
Okay.
And you got crisp sage leaves, and you got this delicious pumpkin, and you got this mess of onion, and then throw in apple cider and apple cider vinegar and boil it down to nothing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I make cider on my farm.
You do?
Yes.
Oh, heck. All right. Follow the whole recipe, except instead of the wine, use your cider.
Okay.
And do you ever make cider syrup from your cider?
I haven't.
Okay, this is where you take a ton of cider and you boil it down literally until it's like a syrup. And it will keep forever. And I use it like on pancakes and stuff because it's tart and sweet at the same time.
What a great idea.
Oh, it's fabulous. Somebody used to sell it and they stopped doing it. And I was so sorry. Hey, you may now have a business.
Oh, I'm real pleased. Can you give me use for a lot of pumpkins and now for a lot of the extra cider?
I am cleaning out your farm, man.
You are.
You enjoy.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Sometimes Thanksgiving dinner is a social minefield, and if you don't know the code of manners, you're in trouble. Well, the same thing is true in business situations. Make-or-break moments are legion in foreign business travel. I mean, especially in Asia. Like when you think your response to your host is good manners, and in reality, you've just insulted him. Foreign etiquette is often counterintuitive. Well, this is what cross-cultural educator Mary Bosrock specializes in. She's written Asian Business, Customs and Manners. Hey, Mary, welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Mary, I'd like to talk about the business dinner in Asian countries. What are the biggest blunders we make?
Well, you know, I think, number one, when you're doing business, you need to enjoy food. And you know this as well as anybody, that food offered is friendship offered.
Yeah.
And sometimes business people go with these squeamish stomachs or with their American mindset that they want a steak and baked potato. And that can be disastrous to a friendship.
Well, how do you handle situations, though, when you're offered food that you really find off-putting? I mean, and you don't want to insult your host. I mean, I'm remembering my husband on his first trip to Japan was offered the eyeball of a fish, and he ate it, and he was very grateful for it. But I could imagine a lot of people would just not be able to deal with that.
Well, you know, I found a nice little trick. I usually find something that I really like in a country.
Right.
And then when I'm meeting with somebody, I make the comment that I can't wait to try your tempura again or your Kobe beef. And that kind of gets you away from sometimes eating the eyeballs, because the Asian hosts are extremely hospitable, and they're going to want to do everything to show you a wonderful time.
Is it insulting to use a fork if you really can't handle chopsticks?
You know, I would use chopsticks even if I did it poorly.
Uh-huh.
So the Chinese have a saying. They say, when you come to our country, crawl like a baby. And so if you eat with chopsticks and you don't do it very well, it's almost even pleasing to them because they see you trying. And I can guarantee you, Lynn, they will say to you, you are doing a wonderful job. You're very good with chopsticks, no matter how bad you are. And it's okay to slop a little bit on the tablecloth. It's not like in Europe, if you drop food all over the tablecloth, you're going to be embarrassed. It's fine. They say a dirty tablecloth is a sign of a very good meal.
Oh, that's a relief.
Yes.
You write about something that I think, you know, talk about that business about you think you're doing it right and you're not. Eye contact in many Asian countries.
Absolutely. You know, I had a woman call me recently, and she said she was so insulted because she made a presentation to a Japanese group, and they didn't look at her.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in the Asian cultures, particularly when you're talking to the opposite sex, you show respect by dropping your eyes and not looking directly into the eyes of the other person. You know, it's kind of a privacy issue. This is a person's soul and is seen through their eyes, and as a result, very often people, particularly men with women, will drop their eyes when they're talking with you. And it's respectful.
Interesting, because that we think of eye contact as that we're really being honest and open with everybody.
Absolutely. And we think people are maybe not telling us the truth.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing, cleaning your plate at dinner, eating everything. It's a compliment.
Absolutely. I would eat a lot of food if I was at a banquet in China or
right.
at a dinner in China, but always leave a little food on your plate, because that's a sign that your host has been generous with you. And if you don't, they will continue to refill your plate. And you may be stuck on the fifth course for the rest of the evening.
Mary, thanks so much for the tips. Thanks for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Mary Bosrock is author of Asian Business, Customs and Manners. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week and a fine Thanksgiving. And let me leave you with this thought from Irv Kucinich. He said, "An optimist is a person who starts a new diet on Thanksgiving Day." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle, our newsletter devoted to, well, baking. It's the season to fire up your oven. So sign up, splendidtable.org. And just in case you miss us one week, you can find free podcasts of our entire program at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.